the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. Like always, I have Jason sitting over in the corner, ready to talk. Ben's here on the couch with me with his wonderful poofy hair. And we got a very special guest, Mississippi State alumni and former graduate student here on the phone line, calling in to tell us about his experiences as a crop consultant and what he's seeing in the field. So, Mr. Tyler Heidrick of Heidrick's Crop Consulting, how you doing today, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm glad y'all called, and look forward to getting to talk to y'all all day long.
We look forward to it too, man. Hey, so tell folks who you are, man, because you are in Northeast Arkansas, but you got some pretty deep roots in the Mississippi Delta. So
he's got maroon blood coursing all through his veins.
Tell folks who you are, just briefly, dude.
Yeah, I can assure you, you'll never hear me calling the Hogs, even though I am from the state of Arkansas, like Bobby and Jason. But my family is from the Greenville-Hollandale, Arcola area. My uncle, he does a little bit of farming over there next to Lake Washington. My dad, he graduated under Dr. Shaw at Mississippi State with his master's and got his bachelor's in entomology. And he was there at the same time as the world-famous Angus Catchott. So me and Angus kind of go back a little ways too. But, you know, my family, they're all from the Mississippi Delta. I even talk like I'm from the Delta sometimes and not from Arkansas, and I've been accused of that multiple times. But, you know, I've grown up watching the Mississippi Delta and trying to achieve the yields that y'all can achieve on those Deer Creek ground. But, you know, my dad moved to Arkansas back in 92 or 93. Anyway, and so I've grown up in the Jonesboro area, and Dad started a consulting business up here. He's been real successful with it, and I'm kind of following in his footsteps now. And anyway, he pushed me to go to graduate school, and got to hang out with Jason and Bobby for a couple of years and enjoyed getting my master's in weed science. And now I've got some good friends like Ben that I got to meet in graduate school, and, you know, of course y'all too, but, you know, I can call on y'all anytime, and we don't even have to talk work. We can just, you know, talk about shooting bows or hunting or whatever we want to do.
And you've got two younger brothers that are at Mississippi State now?
I've got one younger brother that's still in school at Mississippi State. He is a senior this year, I think, maybe a junior by hours. He took to the liking of his older brothers, where he liked to hang out and party a little too much, so he got a little behind. But otherwise, no, he's the only one there. But I've got three younger brothers total, and both of them live up here. The other two live in Jonesboro, and Cobia's in Starkville, right?
Okay. So what does the crop look like in Northeast Arkansas, Todd? I know you've been seeing the stuff you post on Twitter, and it seems like y'all are progressing pretty smoothly up there too, with the exception of some rain you've had in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, everything has looked, you know, relatively good, you know, especially for the planting window that we had. You know, we plant a few hundred acres, get rained out for a week, plant a few more, get rained out for a week. But, I mean, really everything's maturing pretty smoothly. Up until that hurricane came, I told you we were about to have a bumper cotton crop. The rice crop, you know, we're cutting a lot of rice right now, and it's all pretty decent. I wouldn't, you know, we've had a few fields here or there that, you know, we've got some milling problems with or something like that. Well, you'll get that when you don't have rain for near 70 days.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that, because, you know, everybody I'm talking to consultant-wise over here says this may be the best Mississippi rice crop that we've had in a long, long time.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Now, we've had some fields where, you know, traditionally they might have yielded 180, 190, and they're bumping well over 200 now, and, you know, they had a good year. What I'm seeing is kind of like the earliest planted stuff that we had, you know, the mid-March planting window that we had. We planted a lot of rice right there, and then we had that super cold May, and it messed up I think, some of that rice at tillering. And so it didn't really tiller out that well. And then when it did tiller, I think that kind of contributed to some of the milling problems that we're seeing in some varieties. But
I think that's where you start talking about the differences in the latitude in that northeast Arkansas area versus the latitude down here. Our May wasn't super cool. It wasn't cold, so to speak. It was cool, but like you, I think our late March planted rice didn't fare as well as our mid-April planted rice this year.
I 100% agree with that. I mean, don't get me wrong, we've still got a really good rice crop, and I think as a state, we'll probably have a really good rice crop. For what rice got planted down south, it's, you know, I think that they're having a really good crop as far as I know. You know, the hurricane kind of messed up a bunch of stuff. We got a bunch of rice that tried to lay down and, you know, double nitrogen areas that are going down. But, I mean, we're picking them up and still getting pretty good yields out of it. But the one thing that I want to say really is, you know, our weed control in rice this year was top shelf. I mean, we had a few fields that kind of got away from us, but for the most part, the majority of our acres, we didn't have to do any of the Hail Mary clinchers or Rice Stars or any of that, where we were just like, let's just throw it at the wall and see if it sticks. I mean, we didn't have any of that really. And, you know, even in some of the fields where we did that, I saw one field that completely cleaned it up, you know, big tillered out barnyard grass and spray it with clincher, and it killed all of it. I mean, it was really, really good weed control this year. I can't complain about anything. Full page system really opened up a lot for us, getting to use that 6 ounce of preface and the postscript. It really, really helped our rice crop out. And, you know, another thing too that kind of shocked me this year, I didn't think our corn crop was going to be as good as it is. And man, we've had a stellar corn crop.
Tyler, I know back on the rice, I know that y'all pretty widely adopted the row rice, fur irrigated rice, whatever, you know, terminology you want to apply to it. But what's your sense on that? I mean, our rice crop is bigger this year, and along with that came a higher percentage of acres that were devoted to this, you know, what amounts to a new system. So what do you think about it after dealing with it for a few years now?
Yeah, I would say that we're probably, as a consulting business, we were probably the first big adopters of it in northeast Arkansas. There's guys in the Boot Hill who have been doing it for years. But as far as northeast Arkansas goes, we probably adopted it before everybody else. And, you know, it's caught on, and it is an avalanche at this point. I was going to say a snowball rolling down a hill, but it's an avalanche.
Maybe everybody in Arkansas, but those boys in northeast Louisiana was, I think, some of the early pioneers of the row rice.
Yeah, they've definitely been doing it for a while themselves.
Yeah, that little Boot Hill, Missouri area, I know they've been doing it for 20-plus years. And, you know, it's got its places where it's started and it's hung around for a long time. But, you know, in northeast Arkansas, it was probably 8 years ago that we had our first field, and ever since then that acreage has increased. And I mean, we've got guys this year that didn't pull a single levee across their farm. And, you know, I'm excited about it because I like row rice. I think that it's got a really good fit in some areas. Some areas it doesn't. I mean, I've seen it completely flop. And, you know, that's the risk you're willing to take to save a little money on the back end when it comes to tillage and field preparation. And
easier for you to ride that motorcycle across the field with no levees, isn't it?
See, you'd think that, but when it comes to row rice, I can't ride across the beds because they're so small. If I ride across them, the water will jump on my tire track. So I actually have to go down the furrow. But in a levee field, I can just zigzag through it pretty quick. And, you know, we're most of our rice, they pull levees right before flood. So it's just a flat field, and I can ride out there pretty easily. But yeah, that motorcycle, it makes things a lot easier, checking for grass and other spotty weeds that you traditionally see in a rice field. But as far as row rice goes, it's, you know, it's something that as a grower, you have to, the first thing you have to do is understand the varieties that you're planting on it. You know, you can't go out there and just assume that you can plant whatever. Jupiter works really well on row rice. It has a, you know, we spray all of it for blast, but we never really get bad neck blast in Jupiter. So that's a variety that I'm pretty comfortable with. 753 is a great row rice variety. 7321 looked good on row rice this year. 7521 looks good on row rice, but it demands the fungicide on row rice. And that's something that, you know, in a levee rice system, you don't ever really think about spraying hybrids with a fungicide. You know, it's not something that everybody does. I recommend it for kernel smut and false smut, but in row rice, it's not a tradition, or in levee rice, you know, people try to get by without doing the fungicide. In row rice, you cannot do that. I want all of mine fungicided if possible. 753, I feel like I can get by, but Gemini and 7521 and 760, which those three are all the same line, those have got to have fungicides on them.
Hey, Tyler.
Yes, sir.
Just a quick question. So several of the guys that I talked to and several friends of mine that farm here have mentioned, you know, trying some row rice next year, you know, and some of these guys just barely remember their dads or their granddads farming rice. But it's for some of the guys that are going into row rice for their first time, or you know, because it's in my opinion, it's very I'm losing my word here, a very attractive option if you're not extremely familiar with farming rice, or you know, the thought of pulling levees and all that, if you can just plant on your old soybean beds. You know, what are your top three concerns, or what are your top three suggestions just to make sure you kind of cover all your basics, if you were thinking about swapping some of your land from what's been in beans for the last, you know, 20 or 30 years to trying your hand in some row rice?
The first thing is you need to make sure it waters. The worst thing that you can have happen in a row rice field is have a bunch of hot spots. So that guy really needs, the guys that are just getting into it, that, you know, they haven't grown rice in so long, you've got to keep your bed integrity at peak. I mean, it's got to be at peak performance. That's the most important thing. The second most important thing is variety selection, like I just said, which you could make an argument variety selection be first. It just depends on how good you are at watering. But variety selection is super important. The third most important thing, and it really gets overlooked in rice, especially because, you know, traditional rice ground is a sharky clay where we don't think we need to fertilize, and, you know, soil sampling's not that big of a deal on sharky clays because we've got all the CC and all this available potash and phosphorus and all that. Well, I'll tell you right now, row rice, especially coming from beans, you've got to have your potash level straight, because that top end of that field, the top third or half or whatever, you will flush all your potash out. You'll have some phosphorus deficiency showing up in a few places. I mean, I'm to the point now where I think on row rice that I want to tell my guys that they need to be running 100 pounds of potash blanket at planting, because we're losing so much. And, you know, those guys who have traditionally not sampled the ground and grid sampled and done all the fertility recommendations and gotten that ground into a peak, you know, in peak shape, it's, row rice will show your weaknesses on soil fertility in a heartbeat. And I know that'll play into Bobby's cards.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of that this year, especially on those top-end areas of the field where we've had a lot more what used to be superficial diseases that are showing up and coming on earlier in the season than they normally do. And, I primarily think that's a function of two things. One, like you said, is fertility on the top side of that field, and the second is, you know, not having the head of water on the field. Because the one thing we got to remember when we talk about all this, even with the variety selection you were talking about, is every variety that we have in our rice producing systems were selected to grow in a flooded environment, right? We haven't started breeding rice yet for the Mid-South to be grown in an upland environment.
Going back to the variety selection, me telling you fungicides are really important on row rice. I mean, you know, we're doing the same thing with nutrients, where you're that constant flushing of water every 2 to 3 days, it's going to leach your nutrients. And, you know, to the same token, when you're doing that, you're stressing that rice that, like you're saying, was built for a flooded environment. We're putting it in an upland environment where it's getting constant stress, and that constant stress leads to disease. And, you know, disease like sheath blight can absolutely destroy the top half of a row rice field. And, you know, you would think that sheath blight would be something that would want to stay in a flooded environment where it's got plenty of water to use. Well, that humidity on the top end of a row rice field is, I mean, it's like candy to sheath blight, and it eats it up.
What's the preferred method up there, Tyler, on the irrigating? Do they let those, you know, three zones develop down the row in the field, or are they just flushing water through? Is there one that kind of stands out?
Ask that question again, and I'm going to try to understand it better.
So it seems like watering row rice, when you're having a conversation with a guy, particularly on the phone about it, the first thing you got to figure out is how are they doing it? Because there's row rice, and then there seems like there's 50 different ways to do it. So my question was, what's the predominant way of watering it up there? Are they pulling a levee on the bottom and catching the water at the bottom, and then these three zones develop where you've got, you know, flooded rice at the bottom of the field, and then you got this zone in the middle that's kind of alternating, wetting and drying, and then for the most part, upland rice at the top?
Yeah. So all of ours, I mean, if they don't have a way to catch at the bottom, then there's no point in trying to grow rice. Whether that's pulling a levee around, you know, a pipe at the bottom to keep it from draining out the bottom, or, you know, if they have pipes where they can slide boards in, that's the way that I prefer to do it. Just because you can adjust that height as you go. You know, when you water row rice, you're going to start with a pretty small plant, and that water can get really deep on the low end of the field. And there's a lot of people that try to mitigate that issue by pulling a levee a third of the way up from the bottom, which would be, you know, we've done that in fields and it works pretty good, you know, if our fall is too steep or something like that. But on these precision level fields where we've got a pretty good watering situation, we'll just stack boards in the bottom. You know, if the rice grows, we'll add boards to it and, you know, back it further and further up into the field. And then as far as watering goes, you just water till it gets up to the top of those boards and turn it off. So, you know, the data that we've got, we've actually saved some water. There's some people say they don't save any, but, I mean, if you're not saving any, you're not using any more. So, I call that a win, plus it's a lot easier to water. You're not having to go out there and check gates all the time and fixing blown out levees. You know, you're just turning it on and coming back in 12 hours and turning it off. That's row rice watering in a nutshell. Is, you know, there's a thousand ways to do it, and that's another reason why we like row rice so much, is it gives you flexibility in all facets. And even going into next year's crop, the maintenance and field prep and all that you have to do is just minimal.
Hey, Tyler, you mentioned, you know, field prep for next year, and you talked about some bed integrity stuff, and this is kind of a, not an abrupt transition, but, you know, thinking about the fall and thinking about next year, I know on this side of the river, there's been several people that their ears and interests have perked up around cover crops. Me and you have had lengthy conversations on the phone about cover crops and their placement. You know, to what level of acreage are y'all putting cover crops on, or are any of you guys really pushing them hard? Or I know we've talked about, you know, what your rice crop looks like behind cover crops, and there's a guy that's going to do that here next year that I've heard about Friday, and I got another call about putting certain cover crops on fresh landborne buckshot to try to mitigate using cold steel, but that I probably wouldn't recommend that. So just y'all, when do y'all start putting out your cover crops, and kind of what have you seen, you know, with the respective crops following it next year, you know, in the following season.
Yeah.
From an agronomic standpoint, not a fertilizer standpoint or, you know, water quality or whatever, just from an agronomic standpoint.
Yeah, so cover crops, we have guys who have adopted them, and, you know, I don't want to say that any of our guys are into widespread adoption and, you know, full-blown believers, but, you know, we have some guys who threaten to do it on their whole farm every year. We have some guys that play with it here and there, and, you know, the rice cover crop, like what you were talking about, we played with that for 2 years, and last year, you know, it was, for lack of a better term, a disaster, and this year it was a lot better, but, you know, the thing that I've noticed with cover crop from an agronomic standpoint, you know, you want to plant them whenever you get your crop out. You know, there's people who are flying it into their cotton, coming through there and pulling their middles or whatever they're doing to incorporate it, or just letting the rain do it. There's guys who are drilling it behind their behind whatever crop they've planted. Cover crops are terrifying for me. I get it.
I mean, when we haven't generated a lot of data at Stoneville from a sheer, you know, agronomic perspective, in the time that I worked for Jason, we have a hard time growing them, and so we're doing a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. We've got some studies looking at flying it on at different growth stages of beans, and then we're broadcasting some, and we're drilling them and trying to chase down some rabbits just to figure out what's our best method of applying them if people want to adopt them.
I mean, there's the agronomic side of it, you know, Ben, is you get, you know, you're getting a benefit from them, and you have to make sure that benefit is going to pencil out in the end. One of the things that I've struggled with is making it pencil out. You know, the cover crops aren't, you know, for seed, they're cheap, but I mean, it's an investment in your crop, and it's something that, you know, you're trying to protect the soil and all that stuff, and we know about all of that. Everybody's heard it, but you know, there's benefits. There's places where they do benefit. You know, if you've got some marginal ground that you struggle to get in and get planted early, you know, that cover crop sometimes can, if you keep it green and you plant into it green, you can get into that field a little bit earlier, and it, you know, it may increase yield on those marginal fields just because you've got to plant it earlier, not because the cover crop is giving you yield, but more so the planting date is giving you yield. The other side of it is, you know, on our guys that have cover crops, when we go to burn those things down, I beg them to put an insecticide in there. You know, it can be a cheap Lambicide or something like that, but every one of them we've ever planted, we've had some kind of insect come out and, you know, hurt us. Army worms are really bad in cereal grains like wheat and cereal rye and annual rye and all those. You know, we'll always have army worms come off of them. The legumes and stuff like that, it's kind of been weird. You know, we've had earlier season aphid infestations in cotton. We've seen other, you know, root insects that, you know, traditionally we wouldn't see, but cutworms have been another one where it's like, man, you know, we're giving them something to live on during the winter. Just from an agronomic standpoint, you know, we're having to spend an extra dollar here, dollar there to maintain that cover crop. But, you know, if it gets you in the field earlier, that's a positive in our book, especially with the way these past 3 years have been.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that planting date aspect is crucial in itself.
All right, Tyler. Well, we certainly appreciate you coming on, man, and hope that y'all's weather holds like we hope the same for our guys down here. I know y'all need a good crop as well, so we certainly appreciate your time. Do what?
They're talking about cooler weather to end this week, and it wouldn't hurt my feelings if it stayed 95 till September 31st so I can get this cotton defoliated. But, no, I mean, everything's looking up in our area, and I want to say, too, before we get off of here that, you know, I appreciate the research that comes out of Mississippi State University. You know, it's a place I love, and, you know, I don't hide my ties to it. You can read through my Twitter feed during college football season and figure out where my loyalties stand. But the the research that you guys provide is top shelf stuff. And, you know, I call y'all about once a week just to run stuff by you and ask questions, and I value y'all's opinion. And I think there's a lot of people out there that feel the same way that I do. And really, really appreciate what y'all do for the growers. This podcast was a great idea. I guess I need to give Bobby credit for that one. But anyway, y'all do a great job, and I really appreciate everything y'all do for us and for the farmers and, you know, the ag world as a whole.
Well, we appreciate that. We certainly do. You know, we just do what we do. So, again, we appreciate you. We hijacked your morning for sure, because you didn't see us coming. So we appreciate it. And for everybody else, if we can do anything for y'all, just give us a call.
All right, will do. Thanks, guys.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.